the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Now, regular listeners to the Midweek Drive will be well familiar with respect to the excellent work that Penny Roberts is actually doing, especially with respect to a new banking app. But one of the key supporters of that, and somebody who's got her own interesting life story to actually share with us, is the fabulous Laura Mathias. Laura, how are you? Welcome to the Midweek Drive.
Hello, I'm fine, thank you. Happy hump day.
Well, great to connect with your good self. And would you like to share with us, and the listener, of course, how you got involved with respect to Penny, and also how you've also proven to be a wonderful advocate for people faced with their own particular life challenges.
Yes, so I met Penny and David at the Disability Expo last month, and they are just the kindest, loveliest people, and clearly have a passion for making things better for anyone facing any kind of difficulty. But it was when we were talking about their son who has autism, and I was reflecting on the fact that I was recently diagnosed with ADHD. And I say recently, it was about a year ago, but that it makes a lot of sense to me when I reflect on my life and some of the issues I have when it comes to hashtag adulting, including, you know, looking after my finances, ensuring I stay on top of my mortgage, and all these things that other people seem to just be able to get on with. And I just seem to struggle. But I was at Disability Expo actually more because I'm a visible difference campaigner. I've lived with alopecia since I was 13. So I often get people come up to me because I look very different. I am a bald woman, and people often want to ask me about my health and how I am. And what was great about Penny and David is they didn't make any assumptions about me. And that's how I knew that they were people that I wanted to connect with, because they're clearly very open-minded to learn from everyone's experience and ask questions rather than just making assumptions based on how we look.
So here we are approaching the second quarter of the 21st century. Is that still a major challenge when people actually do make prejudices, prejudgments on the basis of, again, the empirical evidence of what they see?
Yeah, and I think it's difficult because there is a lack of representation of happy, healthy, bald people, particularly women. And therefore, it's really hard to exist in this world when you kind of go against any kind of norm, whether that be because you're internally neurodivergent, therefore you behave slightly differently, or you have alopecia like me and you're done with wearing wigs because they're really uncomfortable and you just need a break. Yeah, it's hard to just show up and go about a normal day without somebody coming up to me and making often the assumption is that I'm going through cancer treatment. And I find that particularly difficult because often people have their own cancer story and they want to empathize and they want to kind of share that. But I then have to almost let them down by saying, oh, no, no, it's just hair loss. And then it's almost creating that hierarchy of my problems versus theirs. And yeah, sometimes it would just be nice to go to the shop and buy milk without anyone making assumptions about me 100%. So I think the best way to do that is just by voicing the fact that I have lost my hair at the age of 13, hid it for 2 decades, and now I've had enough and I'm just going to exist the best as I can as a big, happy, bald woman.
Certainly in terms of the overall spectrum of where we actually see folk existing, etc. I mean, I can go back to, in essence, I suppose, from my generation, you can actually say that within the narrative of the fictional world of Star Trek, the character of Ilea in Star Trek, the motion picture, was very much a confident, bald individual. And indeed, the actress Persis Cambata actually did say that she went through a fairly traumatic time when she actually had her hair shaved for the actual role itself. But that is obviously a fictional world. Having said that, we live in an era where an awful lot of elements are all about how are folk represented, because in essence, it's the shock of the new, the unusual, that almost biologically people tend to be hardwired to be unprepared for and ill-prepared for, etc. So do you think that there is an argument for, within mainstream media at least, looking to actually ensure that the oft-trumpeted views of diversity and so on needs to actually be continually appraised, continually analysed in terms of, do we see adequate meritocratic representation of folk across the base, no matter what the conditions might happen to be.
I think representation isn't adequate for anyone really at the moment. I don't think what we see on screen, whether it be Hollywood or sometimes even our soap operas or whatever it is that you all kind of what programs you absorb, I don't think it is a realistic representation of who we see when we go out in the street. And obviously that depends on which town you live in and where you live, but I do think there has to be better, stronger responsibility for them to be actively kind of recording, especially when it comes to what I deem visible difference. And of course, there is hidden disabilities and neurodiversity comes under that. And that is something I also have. But I just don't see why, when, for instance, the BBC can do more to increase regional voices, and accents across their programming, that seems so simple. And yet, when it comes to representing visible difference, there's no marker to record that. It's just not in their diversity recording systems. So that is something that charities like Changing Faces UK have gone to them and said, could you think about maybe adding that in? But of course, I understand it would be impossible to feel like we could adequately capture every single individual's unique makeup and feel represented every single time you watch a programme. But let's just put it this way, some of my fellow campaigners can cite a moment as a child where, for instance, they saw a character incidentally represented who just happened to have limb difference, for example, in a children's program. The fact that they can cite that one incident means that representation is not common enough, that it stands out for them as the one moment they felt they were seen on screen. And that's the issue. But there are things we can do day to day in terms of the media we create and curate, in terms of our social media. You can actively choose to follow people to learn from their experiences and people that look visibly different. There are creators out there using their own platforms to create this representation where it's lacking on our televisions, for example.
And again, that brings me to another point, of course, because one of the classic aspects that we've had within the mainstream media has been the very pejorative phrase, go woke, go broke, which obviously a lot of mainstream producers have been challenged by the fact that they've simply actually gender swapped or realigned or simply substituted characters in popular narratives, without creating new narratives, without creating new storylines, new experiences. I mean, I cited obviously experience with respect to the Star Trek narrative, which very much was one of the pioneers of infinite diversity in infinite combinations. But there was a line that these were new characters coming on board rather than taking traditionally held characters and then doing a variation of that. I mean, just interested in terms of, do you feel that actually there needs to be a rethink about how these narratives, how these stories, which can be so potent, so powerful, etc., are being addressed, rather than simply saying, what's the easiest thing? Oh, I know. We'll use some of Shakespeare's stuff and we'll do that in a different way, and that'll be fine. We'll do a version of Twelfth Night with ADHD characters who are all this. Not necessarily the best way forward.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of, I often find myself when reviewing content, for instance, recently with Changing Faces, we were provided with illustrations from a children's book publisher and asked to consider if we thought the representation of some of the characters who had visible differences was fair, or what it prompted for us. And a lot of the time, I feel like it's fair to say, you just need to be more creative because you're leaning on stereotypes here. It might be the depiction of a pirate, and you feel the need to have the hook hand and the limb difference and the eye patch. And it's like, yeah, I get it. This is hundreds and hundreds of years old, these stereotypes. But as a creative, don't you want to be your namesake? Don't you want to be more creative and find ways to challenge these things and find new ways to use, not shorthand for villainy, which is so often, unfortunately, visible difference in the media is shorthand for villainy. In fact, I met an academic recently who did a whole thesis and found out that it is literally written into a guidebook for filmmakers about how to use visible difference to denote evil. I mean, it's literally taught to filmmakers, and that's a real problem. And it's boring and it's old. And I just think it would be great to know that there are people in the profession that are actively trying to make a difference, rather than just people like me who are just trying to live my life. but I don't work in the media. All I can do is reflect on it and talk about it and chat to you, etc.
Stereotypes can be dangerous in all sorts of ways. I do a course in which we actually talk about the ways in which stereotypes can, on the one level, be seen as lazy journalism because it's a shorthand way of effectively reducing the views of people, no matter what that shorthand happens to be. We know it's a way of populism from that perspective. Do you think that we are learning? I mean, I said at the start that we are here. We are nearly in the second half of the or the second quarter of the first half of the 21st century, and we're still having this discussion. And to be honest, I can recall the discussion being had in the 90s and the 80s and the 70s and so on, and we were still having issues relating to that whole side of things there. Do you think it's just something we do as a matter of course that actually is something that, or is there progress being made?
I'm 32 years young. I'd like to think that even in my time, since it was 20 years ago, I lost my hair and I can see change. And obviously, I'm looking through the lens of my own personal experience and the fact that it took a global pandemic for me to find the confidence to ditch my wig and just live my life, regardless of what I look like. I do think it does feel like we're having the same conversation a lot. And I do worry it's because there is a warm audience that are open to learning and changing that. But I don't want to sound negative about it because I know there is change happening, but often it feels like, three steps forward, one step back. And that could be in the case of, yeah, there's a great film that I watch and I think, oh, that's amazing. There's just a bald character in that. Fantastic. Sure, it's sci-fi, but she's not a villain. She's not this, whatever. That's really great. And then I'll hear that they're remaking The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And I'm thinking, okay, so how is that being allowed to happen when we've spoken to them as a campaigning charity, for example, and they've promised that they understand the real detrimental impact that some of these representations can have, especially on young people that are then going to go to the cinema and their peers are. And they're going to see someone, for instance, with a facial difference depicted as a villain, or someone that's needing to hide away. And that is an issue. So, in summary, I think and I hope progress is being made. I can see small pockets in my world where it is, but I have to remember I am that warm audience. I am actively engaged and hopeful in this process. For, an everyday person living in their world and engaging with mainstream media, I'm not entirely convinced yet that that shift has happened, and I think it is a fight and a talk we have to keep having.
And in terms of obviously the historical perspective, do you feel as though there needs to be a greater framework through which people can actually view texts of the past? Because the challenge, of course, here is that if you're not very careful, you go down the line of hard rooted censorship. And that can be problematic in terms of obviously what is deemed to be perfectly acceptable to us now may in 200 years from now be seen as absolutely horrendous, and how could they ever believe that that was a viable case, etc. Case in point being just a social change, the number of characters used to, as a matter of fact, lit up a cancer stick within the narrative, etc. And you'd have this across the field from family entertainment right the way through to children's work and so on and so forth. How do we cross that system? How do we get that balance between a hard-rooted censorship line, which says you can't do this, or something which actually allows people to at least have a filter of saying, well, okay, we need to contextualize the concept of the cultural milieu at the time.
Yeah, and as someone, I studied film at university 10 years ago, and this was back at a time where I wasn't really engaging with the debate around visible difference or disability because my head was in the sand, and under a wig, and I just didn't want to be seen as different. But I look back at some of the texts that were on my syllabus and really questionable things that now I wouldn't want them to be banned. It's just exactly what you said. It's about context. As long as I can understand, and there were many films that we watched that by today's standards were shocking, And I think as long as it is just about actively viewing these things. And that doesn't sound like fun for a lot of people. They want to go to the cinema, they want to relax, they don't want to be worrying about having to like self-check and self-regulate how they feel when someone comes on screen. that is something that we can and should be doing, and it shouldn't be so laborious, and it won't be the more we do it. But let's think. Surely the media is the best way to test and check your kind of unconscious biases, and it's much better to have it with a fictional character on your screen than when you see something new or someone new, like me, a bald woman in the street, and realizing you're staring at me for 3 minutes, or pulling a face or whatever. I'd much rather you kind of test that out whilst watching the latest sci-fi than coming and effectively making me feel very uncomfortable in real life.
Lauren, you mentioned where people can actually get in touch with your good self. Can you share the website again for people who might be listening to this who might either know somebody or indeed be in a similar situation to perhaps you might have been yourself a few years ago, whether it be suffering from alopecia, ADHD, or whatever?
Yep, so I'm very active on Instagram at Relight Alopecia. So, like the song Relight My Fire, but then with alopecia, at Relight Alopecia. And if you search for me, Laura Mathias on LinkedIn, that's what I've been focusing on recently, because in my latest job, I've not worn my wig once. So, talking about professionalism and representation in the workplace when you have a visible difference is something that I'm really eager to kind of tackle at the moment. So yeah, that's where people can chat, and I'm always happy to talk to people about any of the struggles they're having, and hopefully the ways they can overcome them if they're living with visible difference.
Okay, so it's another midweek drive as we head into the month of August, and we're delighted to actually welcome, first up, of course, today, the author extraordinaire, of course, creator of Palace Rogue, and so many other wonderful things, including Mr. Two Bomb. Interesting combination between Mr. Two Bomb and Palace Rogue. It is, of course, our authentic, official Edinburgh correspondent, the Englishman in Scotland, William Coles. How are you, Bill?
I'm very good shape. How are you?
Excellent. Well, all good, all reasonably well from that point of view. Just finished a piece that the listener actually may have heard with Laura, who was talking about obviously new narratives. Rather than fighting for diversity and simply gender swapping and race swapping characters and existing intellectual properties, actually opening it up so you create new characters and so on. Now, this could be a bit of a hostage to fortune because we may well be joined in a few moments by a creator of a new version of Romeo and Juliet, which has a happy ending. I mean, your thoughts on this, William? Because I mean, you must have been tempted to say, look, I know that people have actually compared some of my writing to the best of Ben Jonson, Shakespeare, Dickens, and so on, but I've never actually decided to take that text and rewrite it myself.
Yeah, well, rewriting Romeo and Juliet, a tragedy, and with a happy ending. That's punchy. You could do Othello without Othello dying, and I look forward to hearing what he's got to say about it. Is it still, if you're going that far away from the story, is it still the story? Because I think the fact that they die is what makes it sticky.
Well, that is one of the issues that I actually have. I mean, hopefully, we'll be able to connect with so Leo in a few moments. But in essence, that's the whole essence of the tragedy. I mean, Shakespeare writing comedies and tragedies, and what we got here in terms of the reworking by Leo Akinwudike is one which, admittedly, it might well be appealing to Britain's LGBTQ plus community. But it is a distinct deviation without the suicides of Romeo and Juliet. And again, giving the star-crossed lovers a happy ending. I'm just not sure. I mean, again, we'll wait and see what Leo actually has to say about this. I do know that apparently he's also continuing with respect to this, looking to do a reimagining of Antony and Cleopatra set in modern-day Nigeria and entitled Cinderella and Antony.
Okay, yeah. These sort of stories, the ending of Romeo and Juliet defines the whole tone of the play, because it's a tragedy and because they're both going to end up dead. You're not getting many perky pieces in it. So I'm slightly skeptical. At one stage I was thinking of doing a sort of movie take of Orpheus and Eurydice, and the two lovers who she dies, and he goes down to Hades to rescue her. And he's told that she can come out of Hades so long as he doesn't look back at her. And anyway, they're going out of Hades, and Eurydice is saying, why aren't you looking at me? Why aren't you looking at me? And eventually she's on the boat to go back over the Styx, and he looks at her, and he's gone, and he's lost her, and this spirit is waving at him. And it is this that makes the story sticky. This is the bit you have to have. And I think with Romeo and Juliet, although in the film version, only he is dying, not both of them, but you know, you've got to, for my money, they both got to die, or it's got to both end pretty. It's both got to, it's got to end badly.
It's taken from the annals of Alex Levchuk's narratives, which you may have all forgotten. But the Man from Atlantis episode, also entitled the Romeo and Juliet, was also an attempt to rework that. Didn't really manage to do it that successfully, I believe, because the whole essence was that Mark Harris played, of course, as I'm sure you'll know, Bill, by the awesome Patrick Duffy, who again was to go on to more extreme fame with his role as Bobby Ewing in Dallas. In this particular episode, again, it seemed to bring on board the Montagues and Capulets, but only accessed from the bottom of the ocean. Very strange, but still, there we are. I mean, is it can it be said that actually the old line about there are only really five, six, or maximum seven plot lines, that all narratives are intrinsically the same, that you know you're working for the basis of you have a hero or a heroine who has a task, who actually goes out and seeks that task, and you have obstacles to be overcome, and you have that narrative, and actually it really doesn't matter?
You can be experimental and try and do new stuff, but the audiences want their kind of expectations to be met. And so if you start tinkering around with new sort of story tropes and that sort of things, you it can work, but most of the time it won't, because particularly with movies, because people have these expectations. Yeah, it's you've got
Okay, well,
more of a chance of.
let's hold it there. Let's turn to hopefully the author himself, the gentleman who's actually joined us kindly to actually talk about this reimagining of course, Romeo and Julia and friends, of course, described as a love letter to Romeo and Juliet. It's the awesome Leo C. Akiwudaiki. Leo, welcome to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
Hi, we're doing very well.
Excellent.
Thanks for having me.
A great to welcome you on board the show. William Coles is based up in Edinburgh, and he's keen to obviously sort of raise and discuss that because he's a romantic novelist. So obviously fascinated by this reimagining, this reworking of Romeo and Juliet. So I'm going to throw the same question to you as we've been discussing with respect to William over the whole thing. Why?
It's I mean being well, love is a choice, and well, who you love is a choice as well. I mean, being straight, being gay, I mean being LGBTQ, it's a choice. I mean and with legalization, I mean in recent years, I mean it's why not, you know?
Well, that makes perfect sense, etc. Now you're from Nigeria, and we have one of our ace regular correspondents who is also with us, a regular on Madrid Drive, also has, of course, his Afrobeat show every Sunday on Siren Radio. There we are, shameless plug once again. Tosin, welcome aboard. Don't worry about the camera. If the camera doesn't actually work, it's okay. It is radio. Tosin, any questions from your own point of view about this reimagining of Romeo and Juliet? Or is it a case of, look, I'm an Arsenal supporter and I'm devastated as the Nigerian women's football team losing to England recently. I'm too stressed to cope with this.
I'm a little too stressed, but like we can still talk about the reimagining of Romeo and Juliet. I think it's a really cool concept, especially for the LGBTQ plus. I think it's really nice. My own is is you're working for it in the UK, but also in Nigeria, we've heard of news about like LGBTQ, those people, the section being segregated and people not really listening. So are you also like trying to push it in Nigeria too, or in the UK right now? The book, the imagining of this thing, because I know it's meant to help people relate better with LGBTQ and understand love and everything. But in the UK, it's cool. But in Nigeria, I know there's kind of that thing too. So I want to ask, are you doing some kind of thing in Nigeria too? Are you trying to push in Nigeria too, basically?
What I'm open for everyone, I'm open for everyone to read it. It's available on Amazon. So if you want to buy it on, if you want to buy it from Nigeria, you can, yes.
Okay, thank you so much.
But it's
That was
mainly
good.
maybe Europe based and but yeah, but I mean, yeah, but I think I'm open for everyone to read it. I mean, it's a story that I want everyone to read. I mean,
Right, that's good. That's good. I really appreciate that then.
yeah.
And again, a very important question, Tosin. I mean, I think, that there is that line insofar as, yeah, actually, here we are in 2023 in a country which is thankfully reasonably tolerant of areas. I mean, there are lots of challenges, lots of issues with respect to that. And I was looking really to your Nigerian background as well, Leo. What was that also a case of, well, look, you've got to do it. You can't literally hide away from these particular issues. And although Tosin's probably quite right that there'll be people maybe even listening now in Nigeria who are saying, "What on earth?" So it's brave to actually do that. Was that also part of the intention of yourself as an author?
No, I think it's overall, it's not just an LGBTQ story. I mean, it's a straight, it's a story for straight people. It's a story for straight allies, straight friends, as well. I mean, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, here we are, four male individuals talking about a classic romance, which is interesting in all sorts of ways. I know Fia is currently doing all sorts of things in the Netherlands, and likewise, I think Jessica's having one or two challenges. Bill, let's turn back to yourself again. Any questions for Leo now he's actually in the room?
Yes, Leo. It sounds like a fantastic story. At what stage did you? I mean, it seems to me that Romeo and Juliet dying are a pretty important part of the story, and it's what sort of makes it stick. If they just run off, then I don't think it would be so memorable. So, at what stage when you were writing this did you decide not to kill your two lovers?
I decided it from the very start, actually. Yeah, actually, I had it in mind to get married at the start, at the end, actually. It's much more of a happy end instead of the actual suicide itself. Yeah, I just wanted to create life and create happiness and within my story, but I wanted to create drama and tension with, as well with it, you know.
Yeah. So they both run off and they live happily ever after. You know, it's not
Yeah,
like
but I think
West Side
there's a
Story
lot of
where only one
similarities
of them
between them.
dies.
But I think there's more happy. Yeah, there's similarities between them, but it's more happy ending.
The story itself has been adapted many times by Hollywood. Probably one of the most famous is the musical West Side Story, which obviously emerged sort of latterly as a reimagining, a reworking of the whole thing. And I noticed you're doing a reimagining for your next one, a reimagining of Antony and Cleopatra, which is quite extraordinary. Is that, I mean, one of the things we spoke about earlier on the program was the whole essence of maybe creating new narratives, maybe creating different areas with respect to that. And we were speaking to Laura Mathias, who again works extensively for people with disabilities and indeed is often frequently contacted by television companies to actually talk about. How do we deal with representation? How do we actually develop this? Do we go down the line, which seems to have been a bit of a challenge for the major companies like Disney and so on, where you've simply gender swapped or race swapped or adjusted things like that? Or do you create your own narratives? So, Leo, was there ever any temptation to say, rather than saying it's a reworking of Romeo and Juliet, let's just do my own narrative?
Well, I mean, I can do my own narrative. I mean, let's aim at a specific audience. I'd say probably just young adults, probably late teens. So it's not really Disney or something like that, you know? So
Yeah, that well, that works
Yeah.
from that point of view.
But it does have dark themes, but it does have fairy tale themes as well. I mean, so yeah. Within it,
Dark scenes and fairy tale scenes,
yeah.
extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, again, fascinated by this whole sort of things, and I know that you wanted to promote to avoid the death of the lovers, but to send a positive message, and that message to young people about making the right choices in love, certainly I think is something we would all tend to
Yes.
agree with. But I could also imagine Shakespearean purists turning around and saying, "What have you done, Leo? What have you done?"
Yeah, I hope I haven't offended anybody. I mean, as I said, this is an afterthought to the William Shakespeare play. I mean, it is a love letter to the William Shakespeare play too. I mean, if anybody thinks I offend anybody, please do not think that. I just wanted to write my own story and
You went to the Sylvia Young School of Drama. You can't possibly
yeah.
offend people. People in Sylvia Young, they
Yeah.
don't do that. You know, it's all part and parcel of the whole thing.
Yeah. I would pay respect to the original and deliver something that could be something greater in addition to for the future as well, for today as well. That could be not a loss, not a legacy as that William Shakespeare had, but a foregoing legacy as well. I believe the story can have, this brand can have.
Well, it's not for nothing that we actually decided to have William Coles, like William Shakespeare, actually on this particular call, because clearly there's a connection there. And doubtless, William, this was probably in your parents' minds when they actually christened you in the first place.
Perhaps. Leo, do you have much Shakespeare in your story? Do you use many of William Shakespeare's lines?
So it's live. So do
Do
you use
you?
any of the lines from Romeo and Juliet in the
Yes, there's
story?
there are very few. I think there's one point where Romeo and Juliet have a conflict, and his mother, Romeo's mother, says, "Examine new beauties." This is after Romeo and Juliet break up for the first time. Romeo's mother, Imelda, says that, tells him that. Just
Nice.
imagine, examine new beauties.
And presumably you've avoided writing it in iambic pentameter, or was that something you actually wanted to actually do, use as well?
That's
Well, forsooth, Tosin, Tosin, wherefore art thou Tosin? You could say the same about the Nigerian women's team. Sorry. Tosin, any
yeah.
questions for yourself about, again, because Nigeria is a pretty darn big place, basically, and I think it's fair to say you've
Yeah.
got. It's not just two Nigerian sort of background souls in the whole system. Any questions you'd like to put again to our author here?
When rewriting the story and putting your own way, which character was like the most interesting to you, or you're most excited to write about and really go into and see what you can do with them?
That's right. I think it was.
Who
So,
was your
like, when
favorite
you're writing,
character, Leo?
yeah, who's your favorite character in your book right now? Like, the one you loved writing about the most out of all of them?
Which character I love to write about the most? All
Yes.
I'd probably say Romeo's story. Romeo and Moses, my character. Yeah, I think the way he found himself, going into his 30s as a gay man and breaking up from his relationship with his girlfriend Poppy and find love with her best friend Julio and changing his whole life and his whole lifestyle, coming out to his family, everything, yeah, changed his whole life and actually adjusting and having a supportive group of family and friends, and that was really important to me. Yeah, but I think also I loved writing about Julio, how he found himself from an abusive relationship and came back to his friends and found new love as well. But I think I hated that I had to write it to be in a kind of toxic kind of what you call it love triangle with his best friend Poppy,
Yeah.
but I had to kind of write that. I wanted to write that, but
I
but
mean,
I'm happy that they did find love and they did go forward with it. But it was just so that it just sounded good to me to write something a bit controversial, just to like a kind of love triangle with a woman, but yeah.
Again, I was fascinated that you have a character called Romeo Moses, because you got basically Moses, the leader of the Israelites, mixed with Romeo. And listen, let's move Leo on to something to a slightly different thing, because obviously, I mean, fortunately, you've never personally been the target of homophobia. However, there is an interesting fact here, which, I mean, we talked and Tosin rightly raised the issue about how this may or may not go down in Nigeria with certain official channels. The latest Home Office statistics in Britain have shown that hate crimes against people based on sexual orientation have doubled in 4 years. So clearly there are issues with respect to this, and intolerance is increasing across the UK. Was this something in which you, you know, is the agenda, if you like, from this point of view, and again, you went to the Sylvia Young Theatre School, dubbed Eton for the pop idol generation, which I must admit, I never actually, I mean, Bill Coles, Sylvia Young Theatre School, Eton for the pop idol generation. Anyway, in terms of that, this renormalizing of relationships, was that something which you had very much in focus right from the off, Leo?
Yes, I did. Yes. They do, the antagonists, they do bad things, but they're motivated by their love for the protagonist. And it's not necessarily a homophobic crime, but I mean, but it actually is, but I mean, but it's more motivated by what the protagonist did to them in betrayal, but it still is wrong. Yeah, I mean, it's more with the theme of Romeo and Juliet, you know, but less, more or less, with homophobia itself. Yeah.
Okay. And again, is the intention to have the text performed? Will it be written as a stage play? Will you be? I mean, you know, literally the heart of the Edinburgh Festival. William Coles up there for that point. Is it something you're looking to take on the road, or is it a case of no, it'll stay as a novel?
I did when I did get signed 4 years ago. I did get a lot of rights to this novel, and I've been considering a lot of things, and a lot of things have been rewritten and done. So, you know, fingers crossed, you know, we'll see.
Okay. And I've got to ask the question, Antony and Cleopatra, set in modern day Nigeria and entitled Cinderella and Antony.
Cinderella, yes.
Yes. Okay.
Cinderella and Antony, yes. Yeah. That will be set in Nigeria. It'll be set in Nigeria. Nigeria and Britain. With Nigerian royalty as well. So, well, based on Cleopatra's Egyptian royalty. That's what,
It's astounding.
That sounds really nice. Nigerian royalty. I would love to see that.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that. Which part of Nigerian royalty, though? Is it like the Yorubas?
I'm both, from both parents. So, I'd probably base it maybe Abuja, maybe.
Okay. That's good. I'll be expecting that. That would be a really fun book to read.
Yeah.
And Tosin, as we know, is Nigerian royalty, so this is very important. Just the thought. Bill, any other closing questions for Leo you'd like to put at this stage?
Are there any other writers apart from Shakespeare whose works you'd like to have a go at redoing?
Maybe William Coles, for instance.
You mentioned the Cinderella. I mean, I'm doing Cinderella as well. I mean, you did mention that, but I mean, yeah, I'm doing Cinderella. But I took in the sense because I want to, maybe after this, I'm going to try a bit more original stuff after this. But I think I'm open to other texts from other writers. Yeah, yes. I don't want to name them yet, but I'll probably do a few more in the future.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, as I said at the start in the intro with Bill, you've got your Charles Dickens, you've got so many. Let's just agree, it could be a whole range of things we'll be working on that sort of system. But there we are. Leo, it's been awesome connecting with your good self. I'm going to throw the last two questions to Tosin at this particular stage. Tosin, would you like to ask Leo, because I know you can do this, you've been part of the whole show, you've done them in the studio, you've done them online, you've coordinated all sorts of other bits and pieces. Go for question one, Tosin, please.
Okay, the first question is, did you enjoy this Zoom with us?
That's right.
Did you enjoy this Zoom with us? Did you enjoy this
meeting? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I did very much. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah,
then second question, would you come back? Okay. Then second question, would you come back another time?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, I'd love to. This is very good. I really enjoyed this. I'm waiting all day for this, you know?
That's good.
We do often feel as though, as Bill Coles will attest to, we're providing like a social service for authors who basically needs to actually engage with the other world, basically all sorts of ways. It's just a thought there. Leo, how can people get hold of your book? And is it a case of it's available, as you said, on all online systems, even in Nigeria, if you want to smuggle it in?
Where you can buy the book, you can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, where else?
It's all the major platforms.
Yeah. Oh, social media platforms. Oh, sorry. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Threads. Yeah.
And have you actually started doing a TikTok video as yet for it?
Yeah, I'm going to join TikTok soon. I mean, I'd need to get all my ideas down first. I mean, I've just generated lots of ideas first, but I will join it end of this year.
Well, it's awesome connecting with your good self. And just, did we get your pronunciation right? I mean, I know it's Leo, but is it Leo Akiwuduki or Daiki?
It's Leo Chidozie Akisake. It's Nigerian for God's plan.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Leo, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. And I'm sure we'll speak again very soon. Meanwhile, Bill Coles, has it been a reasonably interesting Zoomer for yourself?
I've loved it. Please may I come back?
I think that's pretty much sorted through. Tosin's going to be back with us because up next, we're into curry, a history of curry in the United Kingdom, with Kadeem Hussain and others sharing his history of curry from the Asian perspective and how actually without curry, well, frankly, Britain would not be the Britain it is today.
There you go. Can you ask him a single question?
Of course.
Can you ask a question?
Oh, yeah.
Did chicken tikka masala really originate in Scotland?
That's an important one. And we'll make sure that we put that, either Tosin to myself, to Kadeem in a few moments. For the moment, though, to Leo, to Bill, huge thanks. And time now for this.
The Midweek Drive Team. Four words which signify quality and all that's best in audio entertainment.
Well, Tosin, you can tell that we're beginning to expand in all sorts of ways here because we move from Nigeria and your own home base, etc., and the reworking of Romeo and Juliet over to a gentleman who moved over from Asia to Britain, Pakistan, India, a whole range of things. A good friend, actually, of a sister programme that we do. Keen Middlesbrough supporter, though, Tosin. So, I mean, I'm not sure how you sound on that. Allowing for the fact that Chuba Akbom, one of the main players of Middlesbrough, was indeed an Arsenal reject. So on that basis alone, you know, you could say there's a bonding that could be had over this. But Kadeem Hussain, welcome to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
Fine, thanks for having me.
Excellent. Well, before we actually talk about the great event that's taking place in Middlesbrough, yes, 126 miles north of Lincoln, in the not-too-distant future, perhaps we can actually throw that last question that William Coles left us with from his base in Scotland. And the question is, chicken tikka masala, was that dish actually originated in Scotland, or is that just an urban myth?
I think it's an urban myth because when this dish was invented, there were no tandoors, the clay ovens in Scotland. So it was London.
Well, there we are. You know, William, obviously listening to this, we'll have to relay that news to what I'm sure will be a devastated group of Scottish people who actually will have to acknowledge that that simply was an urban myth. Oh, okay, let's move on to something which is particularly interesting. It actually takes place at the Masham, 27 Linthorpe Road, Middlesbrough, for 90 minutes, actually in the very near future, in fact, next week, I think, from that point of view. But this is basically the story of curry powder with Kadeem Hussain. I'll initially talk to Tosin to start with. Tosin, either in Nigeria or in Britain, are you a keen fan of curries?
Yes. I literally just used curry for my eggs like this morning. So I use it in everything. Curry is like my go-to spice. So I'll love to learn a lot more about it from Kadeem.
Okay, then. Tosin is keen to follow through with this, Kadeem. So share with us this talk about the heritage of curry on the Teesside, specifically the history of curry powder. What first attracted you to the history of curry powder?
Well, the thing is, you know, I did my book Going for a Curry. And in that, I read an interesting story about this Indian officer coming back in the 16th century. He was high up in the East India Company, and he was coming back from Madras And he said to his cook, he said, you know, I'm going to miss your curries. What do we do? So guy grabs some spices, put them in an airtight tin, and said, there you are. When you get home, stir them into your food. You've got instant curry. And that's a great story, but I can't find any background to it. It's never been mentioned anywhere else. And since I'm doing this talk, now it means hard research. I think I'll need to go to the British Library in London, find out, to go through the East India Company records.
So it's all thanks to the East India Trading Company and somebody who actually quite fancied curry for it from that point of view. Tosin, questions for yourself first, please.
Okay, how many types of curry are there? Because I've seen spicy Madras curry, I've seen the normal curry, I've seen like spice, like what's the word? There are those different types of curry. So how many varieties of curries are there, basically?
Well, the curry is something that's a special taste for everybody, has different taste.
Okay.
To the Indian individuals, if you're from India, you should be able to taste all the other spices. So once the curry starts to burn your mouth, then it's not curry anymore. Because all you're doing is taking all the spice away and you're adding more chili powder in it. So anything that burns your mouth, that's not true curry. True curry should be able to taste spices. And as you eat, as long as you get the flavor of spices coming through, all the other spices, not just the chili powder.
Okay. So I should just get the original curry, no flavored curry, nothing like that.
Well, the curry is, so anywhere you go, right, from any country, they got their own curries. And if you were sort of in the Friday night, Saturday night, late night, in any curry or takeaway in UK, Britain, you get people will be coming out, especially in the 80s and 90s, would go with the very hottest one just to show I'm macho. You know, I can eat it. So they would get some of the fowl, which is liquid, some molten, you know, lead, if you like, with lots of chilies in it. But it's to everybody's taste. And why do you use it? Do you use it as a status symbol? I am tough, I can eat it. Or do you taste it for the food itself, the spices?
Okay, no problem. I like that.
I mean, I'm fascinated, actually, Tosin. When you were in Nigeria, it was the ability to actually withstand a really hot curry seen as a badge of growing up, really?
Kind of, no. Because it depends on tribe. Again, in Nigeria, the Yoruba tribe eat a lot of pepper, so like spicy curry, it shouldn't be spicy for you. But like other tribes, maybe the Igbos, the Hausas, other tribes, it can be a little spicy for them. So for me as a Yoruba person, like, it shouldn't be spicy for me. It's a normal thing. It's a thing we eat in our house almost every day, kind of thing. But like other people, yeah, they want to show that, oh, we can take us the spiciest curry as you guys, and nothing will happen. And yeah, but for me, it's a daily thing. Yeah.
Like chili peppers. Well, that's another line entirely.
Also, that's an interesting thing, because when we had the restaurant from 1990-2002, there was a restaurant in Newcastle, and they had this hottest curry. And it's a badge and honor. They made you sign this form, right? And if you sort of at the curry, you were the king. And I think very few people managed to eat it. But that, in the, so the Indian takeaway houses, the curry houses, it became a badge of honor. I'm going to go and eat the hottest curry, whether you tasted anything or not, or you were ill. Yeah. Later on, is another matter. But you still at the hottest curry. In fact, actually, I wrote a play based on the fact that, you know, there's a lad who walked into an Indian restaurant, and this is weekdays, there's no women to show off, and they're all ordering. One guy says, I want my fowl. And the waiter said, you know, it's hot. And I said, I like my curry hot. Been all over the country. And he's just walking by, and he says to him, by the way, tell the waiter, tell the chef, right, the last curry fowl he made for me was tame. Now, that's lethal. You never do that. So this waiter went in, and rather than giving it to the chef, he gave it to the dishwasher. He said, here's the order. And the chef saying, I'm the chef. How dare you? He said, turn around to the waiter, dishwasher. He said, how do you make a fowl? He said, well, you put some chili powder in, stir it, put some more chili powder in, stir it, put some more chili powder in, stir it, and that's it. He looked at the chef, said, what did he miss out? And this guy said, okay, I'll make it. And he's just swearing and cursing and make the fat normal, add a few more chili powder, spoons. And then he had this lethal chilies, right? Naga chilies at the time, they were the most hottest. They had half a pound, right? To last them a week. He chopped these off, stir them in the curry powder, the dish, he said, give it to him. One mouthful, sweating, everybody saying, don't eat it. He said, no, no, I've got to eat this. It's marijuana now. So he ate it, right? And he was off work for a month, for a week. So it became a sort of badge of honor. I eat the hottest curry.
We wouldn't recommend that on the mid-week drive in any way, shape, or form. It's very important that you don't actually sort of.
Anyway, get an argument with the woman. Sweet.
Yeah. No. This talk, which again takes place at the Masham, 27 Linthorpe Road, Middlesbrough. When is it actually taking place? I see it's actually Saturday, the 12th of August. Between 12 and 1:30 p.m. So hopefully, as I say, our podcast listeners will be able to access this immediately. If not, as I say, if you're listening to it after the 12th of August, the glorious 12th, you might well say, when grouse can actually be legally shot in Britain, maybe not. It's worthwhile accessing. But let's talk a little bit more about the story of curry powder. What was it, Kadeem, that specifically attracted you to this culinary heritage of curry in the Northeast and in Middlesbrough and so on, that's obviously led to you effectively being the go-to person when you're talking about the heritage of curry, not just on Teesside, but arguably in Britain as well.
Well, yeah, it's been interesting stories to read. I mean, as you research, where one of the things I came up with was the first curry powder that was advertised, and it's just a local connection. Now you've got to wait for this. There's the Endeavour, Captain Cook involved in it. And apparently what happened was in the 1780s, sorry, 1771, the Endeavour came back from Australia. And on it, they had a Swedish naturalist, Solander. And he came back, and the company that was doing the curry powder said, right, he brought back spices from India. The nearest thing they got to India was Jakarta, Indonesia. It's never even there. It was a great sort of advert. They didn't say which company was doing this. So in 1784, they had this curry powder, right, saying that this naturalist brought all these spices, right, from India, and this is a special blend. So they sold that. Great sort of advertisement ploy. Pity it wasn't true, because you know, you've got Captain Cook there, you've got Endeavour. How miserable do you want to be? But unfortunately,
I'd have to sort of, again, for the benefit of Tosin and possibly some of our other listeners, Middlesbrough, the real true capital of the Northeast, despite what people from Newcastle or Sunderland might well say, but certainly something which it's got a lot of pride in James Cook, despite the fact that there are a lot of people who actually say, from a post-colonial sort of aspect, what was Cook doing on those three voyages to discovery, etc.? Clearly looking for the ideal curry powder. Anyway.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Well, the thing is, when people go on about this age of exploration, it had nothing to do with exploration, it was to do with spices. The way, so they were looking for a route to go to India, the other way around, so they could get spices, just to cut out the middleman, if you like, the Arabs, you know, cut them out, because they controlled all the land routes. And going by America, where it's to do with spices. The other thing, actually, I always found interesting is that the most important ingredient in Indian curry is the chilies. But chilies, tomatoes, potatoes were introduced by the Portuguese. Not by they were not Indian. And when you look at the early sort of recipes, curry recipes, the earliest one appeared in 1747. There's no mention of curry powder. There's no mention of chilies at all, red chilies. They used white pepper, black pepper, other spices. And the other thing, actually, is that you know the Portuguese was there in India first, and I also wondered why they never sort of colonized India. And the reason came up when you did further
the footballers
research.
Footballers was as good as they are in Brazil?
Probably, yeah. That was probably why. the reason was actually that when the first Portuguese landed, in India, the first thing they said was, for Christ, spices. So they were more interested in converting people. When the East India Company then landed in there, they said, okay, profit, spices. They could care less. And that's why they became more popular, because they were more interested in trade than the Portuguese. They were more interested in sort of conversion.
Yeah. And I suppose ultimately, it doesn't matter what your faith or religion or non-faith happens to be, you can still actually enjoy a good curry without necessarily having to actually swear allegiance to a particular religious form. An interesting point. Let's talk a little bit about curry powder blending and special spice blends, which indeed will also be present in this particular... It's a very interactive talk that's actually taking place at the Masham, 27 Linthorpe Road, Middlesbrough. I know it well. It's just around the corner, Tosin, should you actually be dropping by on the 12th of August from what used to be a Marks & Spencer's store, I believe.
Yeah.
It's now no longer Marks & Spencer's, but there we are. Talk to us, Kadeem, about that whole notion of curry. I mean, is there an infinite number of possible curry powder blendings that you can actually put together? And is it literally, you know, you never know whether you're going mild, medium, hot, you know, all of those things, it's all in the blend.
Well, not only the mild, medium, hot, it's also the other spices. It depends on what you want to add. And then it's up to your personal taste. There's millions of blends, if you like. It depends on each individual taste who makes it, what's available as well. And what I did was doing this thing with the fox and the girl, and they did a tea blending. I quite like that one. So I thought, when I do the talk, right, rather than just do talk, I'll do a blend as well. And I called it the Borough Bad Boy. Obviously, it's got to be hot, but not that hot. And I based it on a family... a recipe that my mother used to make. Not true because powder, but it's what they used to use in Pakistan. And it's passed on here as well. It's become more important here than over there. So I'll use that blend to get a... but I just like the idea of the Borough Bad Boy.
Well, it's got alliteration. You know, it's BBB, so Borough Bad Boy is certainly in place from that sort
exactly,
of
thing. Yeah.
So, you know,
and also, what I'll be doing is, what I said, I'll make the blender and I've got the jars, 200 gram jars, right? I'll fill those up, and then the first 20 will get those free. Or if you make 22, whatever, they will go free for people.
Okay. I mean, Tosin, have you ever blended your curry powders, or is it a case of I just rely on what I get from the supermarket?
Never ever tried it. Well, I would love to. I would actually love to try it out and see, and put my own things into it and see what I can make, and maybe make a Tosin special curry, you know. But yeah, that would be really cool. But I've been getting for some markets, but that's something I really look into and see how I can make my own curry. Any advice on how to, on what to put in my curry?
The thing with that is, it depends on what your taste is. There is no such thing. I've seen a fairly recently a thing for Irish curry powder. There's apparently on the market. I was surprised by that one. Irish curry powder. What that is, we don't know. I'll have to do some research on that.
It's just dried Guinness, won't it? Or dried shamrocks, perhaps.
Well, that probably, yeah, I'll have to get the packet to find out. It'll taste a lot better than some of the other ones.
I mean, I suppose you've got Borough Bad Boy, so you could also have the awesome Arsenal aptitude or something along that sort of basis, so you could work on that basis. There is a historical precedent, because Paul Merson was a hugely successful member of the Middlesbrough football team, also came to us from Arsenal. So, you know, on that basis alone, you can see there's an Arsenal-Borough connection, which is expanded. Anyway, team.
Well, I hope it's as successful as the Paul Merson, because he took us up. Remember, he brought it to get promoted, and he did. So hope this season we get a similar situation again. We're going to
work
on the premiership. Yoruba's last season with him scoring, it was Ezequiel's cry last season in the championship, I believe.
That's right. Chuba Akbom scored 28 goals. Whether he still stays with Middlesbrough could be crucial over the next few days, months, and various other bits and pieces. But so it goes. Kadeem, this thing is completely free, this thing, this wonderful sort of heritage of Kerry on Teesside, introduction, interactive scenario to the history of curry powders and spice blends, etc. Completely free, 90 minutes, see what we've done there, deliberately 90 minutes, and indeed it's open to all from that point of view. So will you be taking it around the country? Will the story of curry powder likely emerge in other areas of the land as well? Is that a thought?
I hope so. And I said, what I'm going to do is do a bit more hard research. After this, in a few weeks, I'm going to make an appointment with the British Library, go down and do some research. Because I want the earlier part, this is the story about the officer coming back. I want that to see which officer that was.
Yeah. And who was that officer? We know you're a keen historian from that perspective because you're somebody who works that. That's why you can give such a keen answer to the fact that it's just an urban myth that chicken tikka masala was indeed invented by Scots people. Never mind. Some Like It Hot is the title of the programme, of course. Nothing to do with the Marilyn Monroe movie of the same name. Although you could probably actually watch the Monroe movie after attending Kadeem Hussain's fantastic talk on the story of curry powder at the Masham on Saturday, the 12th of August, 12 to 1:30 p.m, 27 Linthorpe Road, Middlesbrough. Can people still get hold of your book? Kadeem, is that still available?
Yes, they will. And also, what I'll do is I'll have my books on sale there as well while I'm doing this.
Excellent. And can they also purchase them online if they can't make that journey north to the far flung land of Middlesbrough?
Yes, they can still either contact me or the X1 people. We are getting running short of this. I think we'll never get a reprint. Unfortunately, the original printers have gone out of business, so I've got to find a way to get this reprinted.
Well, I'm sure that is not a task which you will not be able to overcome. You can obviously find your good self on Facebook. Any other social media that is best to follow, Kadeem Hussain, curry expert extraordinaire?
Well, on Facebook, there's the Going for a Curry website that's launched after the books. You can contact me there, but anything to do with curry, tend to put it on that media as well. And obviously, there's also my email.
And any advice that you'd have for Tosin about using curry powder in mixes and so on? Any thoughts you'd like to just share at this stage?
To me, if you're going to make a curry, to be honest, you should just try with the separate spices. If you're going to use something grinded fresh, it takes time. But that's the best way. Unfortunately, because we're used to the curry houses, the restaurants, the takeaways, there's not enough time. So you've got to be very quick. You've got to get the order out. And that's where all they have the spices individually. And okay. Once the mouth starts to burn, they take all the spice away, add more chili powder.
Okay,
so
thank
all,
you.
It's all in the blend, Tosin, all in the blend.
It's all in the blend, yes.
On the blend.
Have you had a reasonably interesting Zuma with us on the program today? Has it been good for you?
Sorry?
Have you enjoyed the last few moments? Has it been okay for you, Kadeem?
I've loved the last few minutes. There's one thing. I will be doing a poem about the Borough Bad Boy and the tea blend. And it starts off with the history of Middlesbrough.
Well, before we ask you the second question, then, can you give us a little hint of that piece of poetry? Can you give us a bit of reading from this at this moment? It's a little sneak preview.
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Could you give us a little sneak preview? Could you give us a few lines from that little epic?
Well, I'm doing the first verse, right? And I said that this would be read, and obviously I'll be reading all my some of my curry poems, but I thought I'd write a special one for that. And the way I saw it was, everything has its time. I just read that. I thought quite like that. And it goes, once upon a time, the River Tees meandered into the North Sea. Swampland, a paradise for all God's creatures. That's the first stance.
Wow.
Then it'll go on to the industrial thing, you know, with the coal port, the industrial area, Ionopolis. And then we end up with the... Emirates we shall be, and it'll end up with the palm oil.
Indeed,
the
actually,
tea blend,
Tosin, I have to mention, as we have a tea cider with us now, have you ever, in your time in Britain so far, Tosin, encountered the Teesside Parmo?
No, I don't think so.
You don't
What's
want
that?
To, believe me, honestly. It's a heart attack waiting to happen. I'm just saying. I'm just putting out that warning now. You'd be very careful.
No, yeah. I agree with that, but the point is when you're eating it, forget about the heart attack. I think it's worth it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, the final question, Kadeem. Will you return sometime and keep us appraised of matters to do with curry powder and its history?
Yes, of course, yeah. Anytime.